Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell with you. Our next guest is a musician, part of the group Galaxy 500 back in the late 1980s. Author, podcast host. His new book is entitled The New Analog, Listening and Reconnecting in a Digital World. Fascinating book, and we're thrilled to be joined by author Damon Krakowski. Damon, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Delightful.
Such an interesting read, and you know, as radio guys, I think we're even more fascinated by this. And I want to go back to the basic question, which is, you know, when and why did we decide as a people that noise was a bad thing?
Yeah, I feel like you know, that's happening to us online without our signing onto it. Like a lot of things that happen in your digital life, you just kind of click boxes and you don't really get much of a choice. Like those terms of agreement that we all have to agree to, you know?
Mm.
And I think the lack of noise is one of them, because digital audio and digital information in general is very efficient and very cheap. These are the positives. And one of the ways that it gets to be that way is by highlighting signal, the information you want, and eliminating noise, the information you don't want. The problem is that you don't really get the choice to say what information you want and don't want yourself. It's made, the decision's made by other people. It's made by corporations. It's made by software designers. And not necessarily evilly intentioned. I think sometimes very good intentions. But at the same time, it's a lot of decisions that are removed from our own realm.
I was laughing out loud and recalling, as a young guy, buying my first adult stereo system back in the day and being so excited to have that Dolby noise reduction. And as you explained, it was just awful and didn't help. It made the music much worse.
Yeah, sometimes it did. It's true. Well, you know, Dolby was to get rid of tape hiss. And certainly on cassettes, there was a lot of tape hiss. But that kind of noise of the medium itself, like the surface noise on an LP, or the static on the radio when you're listening, you know, especially to AM these days, you get a lot of interference. But those things can be eliminated by digital media. But I think we got to really think what we're throwing away with that. It's not just a bothersome thing. You know, when I'm listening to the radio, I feel like, you know, it's live. You know, it's being broadcast. And I think feel like part of the clue to that sense of immediacy on radio is the static. You know, it's being interfered with. I mean, when there's a lightning strike, you hear the lightning over your radio, and that sense of connection that I don't think you really get when you just have audio on demand. You know, like a podcast, it can sound like radio, but it's not radio because it happens in your own time. And it happens without any noise. There's no noise of transmission. It just emerges out of that black digital silence.
Mm. Speaking of the podcast, the Way of Hearing podcast, I listened to, I haven't listened to all six of them yet, but I am through them. Your first one, you talked with Joe Castiglione a little bit, and
yeah,
sort of that immediacy of the broadcast and how it's changed a little bit in Boston with the fact that the radio and the TV no longer sync up, and it's changed a little bit of what you hear as far as fan reaction sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. I tell the story in the book, which, because it's something I noticed. As soon as television switched over to digital in the whole country, you couldn't line up the radio broadcast with the TV anymore, because the radio was still analog, but the digital broadcast of television was going through a different system, and it arrives later. So Joe Castiglione would call the play, and then you'd see it on your screen. And that breaking of the illusion of it all happening at the instant, I found very kind of sad and painful. I mean, it used to be that really I could open the windows in my neighborhood, and when the Red Sox hit a home run, I heard it. I heard everybody cheer. And now, you know, everybody's getting their information in these digital sources. It actually physically arrives at a different time. Am I mistaken, or are you guys a Red Sox Radio Network station?
Yeah, we are a Red Sox affiliate.
Yeah, that's great, and I'm so glad to know that you're still on AM in Maine, because, you know, that's another thing. Here in Boston, they've switched over to FM for the Red Sox broadcast, and that kind of made me sad, too, I have to say. That bit was just nostalgia, but I like my Red Sox in mono. I don't know why. I don't even hear Joe in stereo.
Now, I have a somewhat different perspective. I do play-by-play for University of Maine football, and occasionally, not all the time, but occasionally when there's a TV broadcast at the same time as my radio broadcast, the delay will be very slight, and it sometimes, if it syncs up properly, it makes me look smarter than I am as I say it just slightly before it happens.
That's very good. Yeah, if you could get a fast enough connection, you could place bets on the Red Sox. You know, listen to Joe before anybody sees what happens.
When you talk about the decisions being made by others, and you talk about streaming audio services and music services, and gosh, how lazy as a people have we become? I mean, I grew up making mixtapes and taking great pride as a disc jockey in my early radio days of sequencing the music properly, but now we even turn that over to some sort of logarithms and algorithms that will tell us what song we want to hear next.
Right, and I think the big difference there is that instead of turning it over to another person, you know, a DJ, for example, or, you know, your friend who's making a mixtape, you're turning it over to a machine, to artificial intelligence, really. And again, I don't think I've met some of the people who work for Spotify building those algorithms, and they are really fantastically intelligent people and well-meaning, some of them. I don't think it's necessarily that they're out to, you know, defraud us. I think they're out to provide a convenient service that people will love. So on the one hand, it's like, well, okay, that makes complete sense. On the other hand, you got to think about what you're trading, and I think, you know, we end up trading a human person on the other side with their personal choices that you learn from with an algorithm that's really built off of your own taste. And if you just get your own taste reflected back at you, I think that's where we get this problem we're all facing now in all kinds of parts of our lives, of these filter bubbles where you just get more of the same back at you, you know? And I think that to break through that, it's really a very simple thing. It's as simple as reaching out to another person, like another person with different views and different taste, and letting yourself learn from them. But that very basic human gesture is actually kind of hard to make online because it's so convenient to let the machines do it for you online. You know, and they do it so well sometimes. Yeah. The Spotify, if you ever try the Discover feature on Spotify, it's remarkable, I find. I've heard from friends with small children that if they let them use their Spotify account, it doesn't work as well, because then you get mixed up taste, you know, whatever your taste is mixed with,
right,
you know, a 5-year-old's taste. But if you keep your account to yourself, it is really, I find, remarkable. But what you get back is music that you like. Now, that's not a bad thing, but what about, how do you find music that you've never dreamed of before? Mm. You know, and maybe you don't like it, but that's how you find out what you really like, or that's how you grow. You know, you get challenged by things. Like, you know, the University of Maine, I was just up there teaching for a couple of days and giving a talk, and I enjoyed being with the students so much, and they were so eager to hear some new information. And I thought that was so, you know, just a simple, wonderful exchange. But that's an exchange that's hard to do online. You know, if you think about it, when you go Googling, generally you find the answers to the questions you posed, but nobody says to you, why did you ask that question? Or maybe there's a better question to ask in the first place. That's the kind of thing a friend can say to you, or, you know, someone with more knowledge of the subject that you're looking into. But it's not the thing the machine says back to you.
One of the things that struck me in the book was your discussion of how the cell phone technology has sort of been engineered to lower noise, but one of the big things you lose is that sense of place and sort of the nuances of what the person are saying to you, whether they're whispering to you or they're yelling at you. You lose a lot of that in the translation.
Right.
The engineers have their reasoning for obviously making it clear, but is anybody sort of thinking, or is there pressure to, you know, go back and get some of that sense of place put back in?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I think there really isn't. I think because we're all so, you know, we're so quick to adopt these useful, efficient online tools. There's very little pushback on these companies. The other problem I find, I mean, this is speaking from my own experience as a musician, an indie musician, is that, you know, the companies that we deal with for music now, like Apple Music and Spotify and Pandora, these are gigantic corporations. They really don't want to hear from me. and they don't really, turns out, want to hear from anybody in my entire genre of music. And then when I meet people who are, you know, more, have more commercial careers, it turns out they don't want to hear from them either, you know, because they're so big. You know, it's like way beyond you can't fight City Hall. This is like you can't fight Google. You know, you can't fight Apple. These are gigantic international corporations, and they really aren't polling us for what we're missing. You know, I think we just keep being given the product, and the products work. They're really well designed. They're clever. They give us new tools, and we go with it. But there's no moment where you say, oh, wait a minute, you know, I kind of miss when you picked up the phone, you heard the background noise of where the person was you're talking to. That was useful information. You know, now we go around, we're forever saying on our cell phones where we are. You know, where are you? Or, you know, you hear people on the street and all they're saying is like, I'm on the street, you know. It's like, you know, if the cell phone wasn't engineered that way, you wouldn't have to do that. You'd know where you were.
Do you think that's sort of, is there going to be people that will search that out on their own? And I know there's an increasing market for vinyl and people, is that nostalgia or is that people searching for a return to the analog place?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both, actually, is my hunch. I mean, I don't have any kind of, you know, data for that. I really just anecdotal. But I meet people who are definitely into it for nostalgia. But then I meet a lot of young people buying vinyl, and I think they're really exploring. And I think that they are interested in another way of hearing music and of experiencing music and having the package there and having the precious object. There's something very fresh about that for people who haven't grown up with it. So I think it cuts two ways. I mean, they're definitely, when you go to the record store now, you see a lot of gray-haired people like me, and that's, you know, partly nostalgia or holding on to old habits. But then you see a lot of people in their 20s. And the vinyl boom, so-called, is actually being driven, as I understand it, from people in the industry by younger buyers. So that's a whole new thing for them. And I think that's great. But it takes, you know, it takes a lot of resources to press a record, more than it does to put out something online. So, you know, it raises the bar, and it can make it just more expensive and harder to do, harder to distribute. You're back to all those old problems. But actually, it's a little even more difficult than it was at the height of vinyl, because there are fewer distribution channels now. There are fewer pressing plants. They're very oversubscribed. And records are really expensive in the store. I'm shocked by how much people are charging. But when we press vinyl now for ourselves, then we learn why, which is it's more expensive than it used to be. And I think that's just supply and demand. There are fewer pressing plants left. So many were junked.
We're talking with Damon Krukowski, author of The New Analog. And when it comes to listening to music, too, to me, the concerns are twofold. Number one is if you're listening to digital audio, you're not getting the true sound. It's so compressed. But you also lose the communal aspect of it. Some of my favorite memories of listening to albums when people did that sort of thing and discovering new music was listening to it with friends and talking about it and picking things out together. And now everybody's in their own isolated little oral world.
Yeah, I find that very strange too, because I similarly always experienced music as a social phenomenon, a social art. And of course, that's what it is when you go out to hear it live. And it's been interesting to me to, you know, you think about this boom in live music that's been going on, which is true. And that is a way of reintroducing the social aspect of music. But there's a much simpler way than going to these expensive festivals, which is just listen to music on speakers, you know, in a room with other people. You know, I was teaching for a while, college freshmen here in Boston, and I would talk to them about what kind of music they listened to in their dorm rooms, and it turned out they never discussed it with one another, with their roommates, because they each were on their own headphones, so you didn't have to have those debates, which I remember being rather vicious at times, of whose music was worth listening to. You know, if you didn't like your roommate's record collection, there was a lot of negotiation went on. But again, that gets back to hearing what you don't like. I mean, sometimes it's really good to hear what you don't like, and not just be always comfortable.
Yeah, when I was in college, I mean, that two of the bands that I still really love listening to were because roommates listened to them. You know, yeah. The Violent Femmes, a band I had never heard of growing up in Howland. My roommate came up from Connecticut. It was one of the bands he listened to. You know, the Talking Heads. In even before college, I happened to work with at a guy at a McDonald's that brought rap music up when he came here from St. Louis. Yeah. He brought a box full of cassettes with him. And, you know, it's 1985, and I'm listening to Sugar Hill Gang
amazing.
You know, yeah. Grandmaster Flash and all these bands that nobody in Maine pretty much was listening to or had heard of.
Yeah.
So you lose that communal aspect of the listening.
Absolutely. And also, and another aspect which you're raising right now, which is the mix from communities, you know, where you hear other people's music, other communities' music, other people's music, other parts of the country. Music that you wouldn't hear otherwise. And when everyone's on their headphones, you just don't hear it. I grew up in New York City in the 70s. It became a kind of a social problem or issue for the city to deal with, which was boom boxes on the subway.
Right.
You know, they even ended up passing a law outlawing them. But, you know, what boom boxes on the subway were doing was sharing the music. I mean, at times it could be used aggressively, but it could also be used really joyfully. And I certainly was exposed to a whole lot of music that I would never have heard otherwise if it weren't for, you know, the sometimes rather intimidating person with the gigantic boombox playing it really loud in the subway. And now, you know, you go in the train and it's silent. You know, everyone's on their own headphones. And sometimes I just wish, like, you could know what they were all hearing. Somehow, you know, share it. Beam into their feed somehow. But that's not where we're at. And that's not where the companies seem to be interested in taking us.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. The book is a really wonderful read, The New Analog. Damon Krukowski, thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Such a pleasure. Thank you very much. Long live AM radio.